But it's always nerve-wracking speaking after Neil because he, talks about all these grand things. While we're going to be a little bit more grounded and down to earth in this course on quantum mechanics. So in this course, we're going to have four lectures, and I'm going to try and cover as much of the material that I think you'll need to know for all of your upcoming quantum courses. There are going to be four courses that I will be responsible for, which are the quantum theory course, which starts in September. That's going to be lectured by Joe Emerson. Then there's the quantum foundations course, which will be lectured by Lucian Hardy. And then we have two quantum information courses, a review and an exploration. So the review, we haven't secured the lecturer yet. We hope to get Ray Laflamme, who's the director of the Institute for Quantum Computing. But he's got a busy schedule, so we haven't been able to confirm that yet. And the fourth course is going to be taught by David Corey. It's a more experimentally oriented course, yes.
Are there review courses, prerequisites for the corresponding expression courses?
I don't believe so, but I would confirm this with Debbie. At least for the quantum information one, I mean, it would be good to do the first quantum information one before doing the second, but I think you can get away without doing it if, if you're familiar with the material. Okay, so that's the courses that I'll be responsible for. And then you'll also have a couple of quantum field theory courses and a quantum gravity course taught by Bianca Diedrich. And so all of these courses, they use different types of formalism. And in the next four lectures, I hope to kind of cover all of the formalisms that you might encounter. It's good to be able to, switch between one formalism and the other. Some problems are easier to solve in one than the other. And so hopefully this will give you a nice overview of the different types of formalisms. So in today's lecture, we're just going to start with the basics. We're going to look at how quantum states can be represented using wave functions, and we'll see how they can evolve according to Schrödinger's equation. And we'll see some examples of some simple problems that you can solve, like the particle in a box and harmonic oscillator. Then in the second lecture, we're going to kind of formalize things and introduce this abstract vector space. And this allows us to talk about states more generally without just being restricted to the wave function formalism. And there, if we have time, I'll also try to cover some techniques that people use to solve more complicated problems. So I'd like to do some time-independent perturbation theory and maybe look at some simple time-varying potentials. Then in lecture three, I'm going to cover path integrals in quantum mechanics. So this will be useful in setting you up for quantum field theory courses. And then in the final lecture, I'll talk about density matrices, and I'll talk about the postulates of quantum mechanics for open quantum systems. And so that lecture, I hope to give you an overview of the upcoming course that's going to be taught by Joe Emerson. That particular course is it's quite different from quantum mechanics courses that you would have seen before, and I think it would help to kind of have this roadmap in mind as you go into the course. So that'll essentially be my Joe Emerson's course in 1 hour condensed, but I hope it'll be useful. Okay, so for today's lecture, let's first start with a classical description to orient ourselves, and then we'll move on to the quantum mechanical description. So classically, we can consider that we have a particle of mass m, and that particle is traveling in this direction. It has a position x of t, and it's traveling because it's subject to some force f of x of t. And so in classical mechanics, our job is to identify what this position as a function of t is. And so once we have that, then we can calculate all other interesting things like the velocity, the momentum, kinetic energy, or any other dynamical quantity. So the goal is find x of t, and then we can compute things like the velocity, momentum, kinetic energy, and so on. And so how do we actually get x of t? Well, we use Newton's second law. So for a conservative system, so essentially all microscopic systems are going to be conservative. In that case, then the force can be described as a derivative of the potential energy. So we can write, let's say on this side, the force is going to be minus dv dt. And here we've got mass times acceleration as a double derivative of the position with respect to time. What's that? Yeah. Thank you. Very good. And so now we have a differential equation that we can solve, and this will give us x of t. Now, in quantum mechanics, things are a little bit different. We can no longer speak about a particle's position. And we'll come to the reasons for that a little bit later in the lecture. But what we need to do instead is to describe the particle by what's known as a wave function. So so this wave function is now a function of the position and the time. And so let's draw an example of a wave function. Okay, I think the boards are broken, so let's see if this works. Usually you can press one button and everything just nicely moves around. Okay, so we have this wave function, but how do we interpret it? Well, thanks to Max Born, we can think about, take a statistical interpretation of the wave function. So Max Born says that if we have a wave function psi, we can write down psi of t, psi of t absolute value squared is going to give the probability of finding the particle at position x at time t. And so it's actually, it was interesting hearing Neil's story about Higgs. So his story was something along the lines of that Higgs didn't predict the existence of this particle in his original paper, but then the reviewers kind of want some sort of prediction as an afterthought. He, you know, said, here we have this particle. And so he ended up winning the Nobel Prize for this prediction. And it was a similar thing in the case of Max Born. So in the paper, he actually said, if one translates this result in terms of particles, only one interpretation is possible, that psi gives the probability. But then, you know, as an afterthought during the review process, he kind of changed things a little bit. And so there's this footnote that says, addition and proof, more careful consideration shows that the probability is proportional to the square of the quantity psi. And so Born as well went on to win the Nobel Prize just, you know, because of this little afterthought of a footnote. Okay, so we have psi of absolute value squared is going to give us the probability. We can be a little bit more precise about this. We can say that the integral of psi of x of t absolute value squared with respect to x from a to b is going to give us the probability of finding a particle between a and b at time t. So this is this probability is the area under this graph here. And so for this particular wave function, it's quite likely that we're going to find the particle in the vicinity of A. And it's relatively unlikely that we're going to find it in the vicinity of point B. And so this kind of introduces some uncomfortable philosophical issues related to determinacy. So Newtonian mechanics is deterministic in the sense that if we've got accurate knowledge of x of t, we can make predictions about the state at any given time using the laws of classical mechanics. But in quantum mechanics, even if we have, you know, the wave function psi, we're not able to predict the outcome of, you know, a simple position measurement. So this is kind of weird. And so people ask this question, is this indeterminacy a fact of nature or is it a defect of the theory? So like if we do a measurement and find the particle at position C, was it always there or did the measurement, you know, make it appear there? And so there are a number of ways that physicists try to kind of get around this. And it really just at this stage comes down to a matter of interpretation. So we won't really like go into the details of interpretations in this course, but the general gist of it is that, you can take this realist interpretation. So if you think the particle really did have this position here, then you have to concede that quantum mechanics is an incomplete theory. Like you need some extra information to describe this position of the particle, for example, a hidden variable. Or you can say that the process of measurement actually causes the wave function to collapse to this point C. But if you do that, then you kind of have to accept that we've got these two different weird evolution laws. Like we have unitary evolution for every single process that you can think of, except when we decide to measure things. And then we have this like weird evolution law where, you know, we have this non-unitary projection onto this outcome. And that's kind of weird, and it, you know, makes you ask the question, like, who is this we that's making this measurement and how does it fit into the theory? It's all a little bit confusing. And so, like I said, we won't discuss these types of things in this course, but we're going to go into it quite deeply in the course given by Lucien Hardy, the Quantum Foundations course. So if that sort of thing interests you, I would recommend taking that course. Okay, so we know what psi is. We know how to interpret it, sort of. But how do we get it? So in the classical example, we solve this differential equation to see how the position evolves as a function of time. And so here in quantum mechanics, we also have a differential equation that we need to solve. It's called the Schrodinger equation. It's written like this, where H is the Hamiltonian operator. Yes? Pardon me? What is the...
Well, it looks time dependent.
Okay. This is the time independent Schrödinger equation, but the title of the section is to get to solving the time independent Schrödinger equation. Maybe I should just call it Schrödinger equation and it won't be confusing. Okay. Cool. Okay, so recall in classical mechanics, the Hamiltonian is going to be the sum of the kinetic and potential energies. So for a particle in 1D, we're going to have the kinetic energy of the particle and the potential energy. And then we just make this canonical substitution where we turn the momentum into an operator. And so that gives us okay, now we have a differential equation that we can try and solve. So the standard approach in these situations is to use separation of variables, where you split the equation up into the time-dependent part and the time-independent part. So to do that, we're going to separate capital Psi into a position-dependent part and a time-dependent part. And so now we can rewrite the Schrödinger equation with a time-dependent part on one side and a position-dependent part on the other side. In this equation, yeah. Should it be minus?
Minus is there, actually.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. And now if we rewrite this on the left-hand side, we can put a bit that depends on time. And so because this bit is only time dependent and this bit is only spatially dependent, the only way that these two sides can be equal is if they're both a constant. So we're going to say that these things are equal to a constant, which I'm going to call E for reasons that are obvious, hopefully. Now, don't be scared if this is all familiar, because very quickly things are going to ramp up and you're going to be terrified that you don't understand anything. So relax right now and enjoy the fact that you've seen all of this before. It's good to just get everybody up to the same level. Okay, so both sides are equal to E. We can just solve them independently. Let's look at the time-dependent bit first. So this is easy to solve. We just multiply by dt and integrate, which gives us the solution that phi of t is equal to e to the minus I on h bar a of t. And then the second part is the time independent part. And so this is the tricky one to solve. And it's what we're going to spend most of the rest of the lecture doing for a few different examples, which is why this section is called the time independent Schrodinger. Okay, one person at a time. Who wants to say it?
Minus h bar square over 2n.
Okay. I don't even have that minus sign in my notes. I should probably fix that. Oh, I will give you guys a set of these notes at the end of the lecture. So of course you should be taking your own notes, but you'll also get a copy of these. Okay, great. So. The time dependent part was easy to solve, but the next part of the program is to solve, this time independent part. And the solutions to the time independent part are not the most general solutions, but they're interesting to examine for a number of reasons. So let's just write down a few interesting properties of the solutions of this before we actually go on to solve it explicitly for different problems. So these the solutions are the stationary states. They are going to be given by the full solution. So I don't mean the general solution, but just the solution that is composed of the product of the time-dependent and the time-independent part is going to be given by the solution to the time-independent part plus a term that looks like that. And even though it looks like it depends in time, the only thing we ever experimentally have access to is the absolute value squared of that or some expectation value of that. And so we'll always have this bit in the, multiplied by itself, which will cancel out. And the whole quantity is going to be time-independent. So the full solution varies with time. But the absolute value squared does not. And also expectation values cancel. So let's say this means that they are stationary states. Okay, so the position is expectation value of the position is constant, and the expectation value of the momentum is zero. So, you know, nothing's ever going to happen. They are also states of definite energy. And we can get the general solution to the Schrodinger equation just by looking at linear combinations of the separable solutions. So, I'll bring it down in a second. So this means that if our initial state at t equals 0 is given as a linear superposition of these of the stationary states, then we can see how the entire system evolves just by looking at that equation as a function of time. Okay, so to actually solve this time-independent part, we're going to need to consider a specific system, and we're going to have to define what the Hamiltonian is for that system. So the first one that we're going to look at is the particle in a box problem. So solving time independent So the formal name for particle in a box is infinite square well, and it is defined by a potential that is zero if x is between zero and a point A, and it's infinite otherwise. So we can draw a nice little picture. So our potential is zero in this region, and then, you know, infinite everywhere else, which is denoted by these shaded regions. Okay, so this particle is going to be completely free in here, and then it's going to have some boundary conditions at the edges here, which are going to constrain the solutions and prevents the particle from escaping. So so outside the well, we have psi of x equals 0. And inside the well, the particle is going to be described by the Schrodinger equation for a free particle. And we're going to have some boundary conditions. And so the reason for these boundary conditions is that we know that the wave function has to be zero outside, and we require that the wave function is continuous. So at these points, it's going to have to be zero. And so now the problem is simple. It's just a matter of solving this differential equation according to these boundary conditions. which I'm not going to do because we don't have very much time and it's not particularly instructive, but I just like you guys to be reminded of what the solutions look like. Okay. So we see that we get this set of solutions all characterized by this number n, where n is an integer. So you can imagine if you just solve this equation by itself, which we will look at briefly a little bit later, you would get an infinite set of solutions, all of the sine waves. But then these boundary conditions pick out only the sine waves which satisfy the boundary conditions. So we get this discrete set of solutions. And so each of these is a wave function, and it's going to have a corresponding energy. So we can call this the eigenenergy. I just want to conserve space. Okay, so I'll just sketch out a few of these solutions. So what this tells us is that the particle can't take on, you know, any energy. It can only take on these discrete energies. And the solutions, at least the first few, look like this. So we've got this fundamental harmonic for n equals 1. They look like that. Okay, so we can see that these functions have a few interesting properties. They are alternatively even and odd, and this is going to be true for any symmetric potential. As you go up in energy, each successive solution has an extra node. That's going to always be true regardless of what the potential is. They are mutually orthogonal. This is generally going to be true. And they also complete. So that means they form a they span a basis for that, for the space of solutions. Okay, and we can use this to find the general solution to the particle in a box problem. And it's just a linear combination of the two separable solutions. Okay. Okay, the next, yes. Yes. I'm starting to see why people like to work in units where h bar is equal to 1. Okay, excellent, thanks. It's really good that you guys keep doing that, by the way. So keep at it. Okay, so the next simple example is the harmonic oscillator. And even though it's very simple, it's a very useful model to know how to solve, because almost any complicated potential can be approximated as a harmonic oscillator, at least locally in the point that we're interested in. So the potential energy for the harmonic oscillator is given by a half m omega squared x squared. And so then the Schrodinger equation that we need to solve looks like this. And so in the particle in a box problem, the nature of the problem allowed us to, break it up into a solution inside the box and a solution outside the box and use boundary conditions to try and solve it. But here it's a little bit more complicated, and we won't be able to make use of these tricks. There is this brute force approach that you could take where you expand the Hamiltonian as a power series. I'm not going to do that. But I'm going to use this algebraic method where we factor the Hamiltonian. And so the reason I'd like to re-examine this method is because it introduces these ladder operators, these raising and lowering operators. And they're analogous to the operators that you're going to see in your quantum field theory course. You'll have these operators that describe the creation and annihilation of particles. And so it's good to just be reminded of that connection. Okay, so to use this algebraic technique, we're going to rewrite the Hamiltonian in a more suggestive form. Where I'm now using P to represent the momentum operator. And so you can see that it now consists of one bit squared plus another bit squared. And so if we want to factor it, there's a pretty standard way of doing it, which we could use if these were real numbers. So let's say if we had, U squared plus B squared, we could write something like, IU plus V multiplied by minus IU plus V. So if we had real numbers. But unfortunately, we don't have numbers, we have operators. But this still kind of guides us in the right direction, and it suggests that we can examine the following operators that will have a very similar structure to this. So we have these operators that have kind of a similar form to these numbers here. They're going to depend on our momentum and on our position. And I've been clever and moved these constants out the front because, you know, I've defined it in terms of these constants because I want something nice to happen later on, and that's I want to get nice commutation relations. But so now that we've got these operators, we can see what happens if we take a product of these two in the same way that we've done for the real number case. So let's take a product of these. So I'm going to look at A minus times A plus. And I get something that looks like the Hamiltonian plus a constant of a half. So it's kind of what we were trying to get, the Hamiltonian. But we've got this extra constant here. And this comes from the commutation relations for these operators. And so you can work these out just from the commutation relations for P and X. And if you've never done that, you know, it's worthwhile just checking that for yourself. And so from that, we can rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of these operators. And it gives us this nice form, H equals H bar omega A plus minus times A minus plus or minus a half. And you probably recognize this to be the Hamiltonian for a harmonic oscillator. Okay, and so now what we can do is write the Schrodinger equation in terms of these. Which is ultimately the thing that we're going to want to solve. And so, I mean, in the next step, I kind of wanted to convince you of something and prove that that if psi satisfies the Schrodinger equation, then the operator A, the state A plus psi satisfies the Schrodinger equation, and the operator A minus psi also satisfies it. But we're kind of running short on time, so I'm just going to tell you that that's the case, and I'll leave it as a tutorial problem for tomorrow if you'd like to convince yourself. So I'm just going to tell you that this is true, and we can prove it later. So if psi is the solution, then A plus psi is a solution and A minus psi is a solution. I mean, it's only a few lines to prove it, but we'll leave it till later. Okay, so this means we already know that psi is an eigenstate of the solution. This is, we showed this in general before. These are the stationary states. So it means that all of these other things are eigenstates as well. So all we need to do now is just identify one of these eigenstates. And then, you know, from that, we can build up all of the other solutions. So we're going to use a few arguments. So it can be shown that the negative energies necessarily lead to unnormalized states. And these are not physically, these states are not physically possible. And so if we take, you know, any state with some sort of energy, if we just keep applying like the lowering operator, we're going to get lower and lower and lower energies. Eventually we'll get to a negative energy. And so we know that can't exist. So there must be a minimum energy state, a state that if we act a lowering operator on it, it's going to, you know, disappear. And so using this, we can define the lowest state. Define lowest energy state. Be A minus psi naught, and we know that that has to equal to zero. And so this gives us a differential equation that we can now solve. And the solution to that is going to be a nice Gaussian. And it's going to have the energy 1/2 h bar omega. Okay, now I missed telling you something. Okay, so so if psi is a solution, then A plus acting on psi is a solution, and A minus acting on psi is a solution, and they're solutions with the following eigenvalues. So we have energies that differ by h bar omega. And so it's interesting that these are nice equally spaced energies. Okay, so back to here. Now we have our ground state solution, which is going to be the lowest energy state. It's going to be a nice Gaussian. And then from that, we can construct all of the other solutions just by repeatedly acting A plus on these states. So they are going to be our Gaussian solutions, which are multiplied by these functions called the Hermite polynomials. And so these homing polynomials are things that you're going to learn a little more about in Dan's course. So he's doing a course on special functions. So I won't go into any more into any detail on these, but I will draw you some pretty pictures of the first few wave functions. And x dependence in, yes. Okay, and the corresponding energies are going to be okay, so I'll just quickly draw the solutions. So we have our potential our parabolic potential, and then our wave function psi of n of x are going to be equally spaced. Maybe I'll use colors for this. And so the first one is a nice Gaussian. The second one we expect to be a odd function because this one is even. So it'll go like this. And the next one is going to be even and it'll have an additional node. And so on. And so Neil mentioned quantum tunneling in his talk. He was talking about how particles can exist inside potentials that classical particles couldn't. And so that's an example of that. So we have this particle wave function bleeding into somewhere that it's not supposed to, not supposed to be. So I can write n equals 1, n equals 2, 3, and 4. Okay. Yeah, I think I was thinking about this as I was like looking over these notes, and I can't remember why I wrote n equals 1. But yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the notes are fine. It's just this. Yep. Okay. Great. So I just want to cover two more interesting cases. The last one is the free particle, which essentially we solved as we were solving the square well problem. But I'd like to discuss some consequences of the solutions for the free particle. And then the last thing I want to do is just remind you of what the solutions for the hydrogen atom look like. So of course we won't go through solving it in detail, but I'll just show them to you. And in the tutorial, I'd like to talk a little bit about angular momentum, and so the wave functions for the angular momentum, or the solutions, the wave functions for the angular momentum rely on the wave functions that we get for the hydrogen atom. So that'll be a useful connection. Okay, so the last one is the free particle. Okay, so it's the same as before, but we just don't have these extra boundary conditions. And if we solve it, we get solutions that look like this. Okay, where A is a normalization constant. But this introduces some problems because if we want to find out what this normalization constant is, we're going to look at the integral underneath the wave function squared and try and set it to 1. And if we do that, we can run into problems. We get something that's essentially infinity, and so this tells us that that solutions to the free particles, the eigenstates of a free particle, are not physically realizable states. And so I didn't say this explicitly during the course, during the lecture, but I'm sure you remember that for a wave function to represent a physically realizable state, it needs to be normalized. And so here we have this problem. Unfortunately, even though they don't represent physical states, we can still use them as basis states to construct physically realizable solutions. So that's very good. So can still use as basis. And so this particular state for appropriate functions 5k, they can be normalized. And this is what's typically referred to as a wave packet. OK, great. So then in the last 10 minutes, I just want to show you the Schrodinger equation in 3D. And I'll sketch out the solutions to the hydrogen atom. And the real reason why I show you this is because I want to show off my artistic abilities when I go to draw the orbitals in three dimensions. So Schrodinger equation in 3D. And we will look at the hydrogen atom. Oh, actually, it's first. So the generalization to three dimensions is I H bar partial derivative with respect to time. H bar squared on 2m nabla psi plus b of psi. And so this operator is just partial derivatives with respect to each of the spatial dimensions. Okay, so as in the case of the free particle, if the potential is time independent, then we can write the general solution as a linear superposition of products of the different parts, the two parts of the solution. So we have psi of r of t is equal to sum over n coefficient the time-independent part plus the time-dependent part. And so for the hydrogen atom, we're going to have a heavy nucleus, which we're going to approximate as, you know, being at the origin and not moving. And then we're going to have a light electron at some radius. It's terrible. It's a radius away from the origin. And so the Coulomb energy, from Coulomb's law, we have the potential that goes 1 over r with some constants out the front. And it's pages and pages of tap dancing to get to the solution, which I will just write down for you in all of its glory. I can fit it in. So I've written things in terms of spherical coordinates. So you've got theta and phi, which are defined as usual. And here we have L is the Laguerre polynomial, and Y are the spherical harmonics. And these are also functions that you're going to learn a bit more about in Dan's course. We have wave functions are defined by three quantum numbers. So N is our principal quantum number, which refers to the energy of the eigenstate. So N can take on values 1, 2, 3, and so on. L is going to be the angular quantum number, angular momentum quantum number, and it can take on values 0, 1, 2, all the way up to n minus 1. And m is going to be the projection onto the angular momentum in onto the z-axis. So you're going to have to define a z-axis yourself, and then whatever arbitrary axis you define, there's going to be a projection onto that. And so it'll go from minus l, minus l minus 1, all the way up to L minus 1 and L. Yes, thank you. Great, so let's just draw some of these wave functions. So I actually didn't bring my notes for this. I'm going to not only show off my artistic abilities, but my memory. The first one is easy, right? It's like just a sphere. Okay, and so this is going to be the, what's the lowest one? N equals 1. And I guess since we don't have scale, so I believe the first one is a sphere, but then the higher L's and M's have kind of spheres inside them. So we can just say, I think L. Okay, I'm now making this one up. I think it's N equals 0, M equals 0, but you guys should check this yourself. So that can be an exercise for the students, is to figure out what the quantum numbers are for the three that I'm going to draw.
Well, you're drawing a contour of constant.
I am drawing a contour of constant R for those functions. Oh, I can tell you what they are. This is the 1s state. I just, for the life of me, don't remember how to convert between these guys. But I mean, that must be 0, 0. Okay, then there's the, I can't even read this. Okay. 2p z state, which, something like this. So you guys can figure out what the quantum numbers are for this guy. So N equals L equals.
So I think it's a contour of constant psi. Constant R would always be a sphere.
Contour of constant psi.
Drawing level curves.
Yes. What did I say?
Constant R.
That
would be a sphere.
Yeah. No, I believe that you're right. Yes. Yes. Of course, it would always be a sphere. So we are plotting the contour of constant psi, which makes sense. Great. And actually, so in the tutorial, one of the things that I'd like to look at is how the states evolve when we start off in a superposition of two states. So one of the simple ones that we'll look at is let's say the particle in a box, and how does the superposition of the ground state and the first excited state evolve over time? So you guys will be able to think about that. But then also you can think about how does the superposition of these two states evolve over time? And so you should kind of think about that before we get to the tutorials. Okay, and the last one, which, okay. Okay, I don't have a name for it, but you guys can figure it out as well. So here we have these two blobs and then this like donut in the middle. Okay, so yeah, you should find out or like guess, take a guess at what these things are. And then in the tutorial, I'll bring my notes and we can compare and see if you guys were right. But in the notes that I'll give you, I have like a whole bunch of little diagrams. A diagram that shows all of the different orbitals, and they're very pretty. Okay, so what have we learned in this lecture? I'll just try to summarize the key points that you should take away. So the first key point is that quantum states cannot be represented by just the position as a function of time, like they can in classical physics. So they have to be represented by a wave function that's a function of position and time. The Schrödinger equation tells us how these states evolve over time. And at least for time-independent potentials, the way that we can approach solving the problems is to separate the Schrödinger equation into the time-dependent part and the time-independent part, and then solve these separately, and then construct general solutions as a superposition of these. So it's a pretty standard approach. And we looked at a few examples that are able to be solved exactly using these models. And so kind of the formalism that we used here is kind of like baby quantum mechanics. I think in practice, researchers in quantum mechanics, you know, in serious hardcore quantum mechanics, don't use wave functions. They use a different type of formalism called the state vector formalism. And so in the next tutorial, we're going to introduce the state vector formalism. And I'll show you how operators act on the states in this formalism and how we can describe observables and measurements and things like that. So for the tutorial, we don't have a tutorial today, but we're going to have a tutorial tomorrow. And I like to, I mean, even though we didn't do any hardcore mathematics here, we kind of were reminded of a few concepts that we're familiar with. And it'll be nice to explore some of these concepts, just thinking about how these states evolve over time. And I think a really nice way to do that is using Mathematica, because you can just plot things and then see how they change, and it'll give you some intuition. And so I would really like it if everybody brought their laptop to the tutorial. And does anyone not have Mathematica installed yet? Yeah, and has anyone, you don't have it?
I have it installed.
You have it installed, okay. But
sorry, I missed the
question. Okay, no problem. And is there anyone who has never used Mathematica? Okay, cool. So I think there are enough of us that we can kind of just start to teach each other. There is going to be a short course on Mathematica, which I encourage everyone to take, as far as I know, but don't quote me on that. I believe there is. But in the meantime, we can kind of, you know, try and figure out how these things, how to, you know, plot some simple wave functions and see how they evolve. So with that, I will end. But are there any other questions? So if not, I'll see you guys tomorrow at 10:30.